mad, marrying a girl he hardly knew, when he said she came from Bootle. We were worried that she'd be incredibly... He paused to find the right word. Common, Amy said helpfully. A scrubber. Vulgar. Leo's lips twitched with amusement. Possibly common. Perhaps I am common, Mr. Patterson. Leo, she said coldly. But never in all my life have I called anyone a whore. I don't quite know what that makes your wife. I said we were worried you might be common, Amy. Now that I've met you, I know that you're not. He treated her to Barney's glorious smile. Amy knew if she blurred her eyes, it would be easy to believe it was Barney sitting with her at the table. In fact, Leo went on, you're quite the little lady, and I'm glad that my son married you. As for my wife, I'm afraid she's sick. One of these days she might get better. All I can do is hope. I'm truly sorry for the names she called you. He extended his hand. Can we put the past behind us and be friends? I'd like that. Amy took the proffered hand. After a shaky start, she was confident that they understood each other and she could regard him as a friend. He stayed much longer than she'd expected, until darkness had fallen and a shadowy moon had appeared in the sky. She told him about Mam, about her brother Charlie's strange new wife, how much Jackie and Biddy wanted to do war work. They were talking about giving false ages and joining the forces like me best mate Kathy. Biddy's only 15. I admire that, he said. Amy kept wanting to ask why he wasn't attending to all the important things he had to do, but reminded herself they were now friends and it would be best if she kept her mouth shut. A letter arrived from Barney the following day. He wrote saying that he might well have enjoyed officer training had he not been missing her so much. He went on to explain in precise detail exactly what it was he was missing, making her blush to the roots of her hair. A few days later, Harry Patterson called at the flat to say he had received his call-up papers and would be joining his brother in the army. "Wouldn't it be nice if you went to the same place as Barney to be trained as an officer?" Amy remarked. She hoped so. She really liked Harry. He pulled a face. "I doubt if they'll regard me as officer material. Unlike Barney, I didn't go to university, so haven't got a degree. I'll just be a common or garden private, like most of the other men. Anyway, I'd prefer to be a private in the army. Even if they offered me a single stripe, I'd turn it down." He looked a bit doleful. It occurred to Amy that on both of the occasions she'd met Leo, not once had he mentioned his eldest son, though he'd had a great deal to say about Barney, of whom he was clearly extremely proud. "Kathy's joined the army," she told Harry. "She's been posted as somewhere in Yorkshire." His eyes brightened. "It'd be nice to see Kathy again," he said. Amy and Barney had always meant to get Kathy and Harry together. It was obvious they'd taken to each other the day they'd all met on Southport Pier. Neither had done anything further about it, but perhaps all they needed was a little nudge. "Shall we ask Kathy and Harry to come too?" Amy would often suggest when they were about to go for a meal or a drive into the countryside on Sunday. "Why not?" Barney would say vaguely. But neither had got round to offering an invitation. They'd sooner be by themselves. Even Amy's best friend and Barney's brother would have been an intrusion into the glorious time they spent together. Now Amy kissed Harry and wished him all the luck in the world. He might be much happier in the army than his brother, she thought, as he had no one to love and therefore no one to miss. The next time Amy went to see her mother, she was dumbfounded to discover that Leo Patterson had visited and offered her sisters jobs in his factory in Skelmersdale. "I didn't realise he knew our address," her mother said, still flustered, although it was 2 days since Leo had been. He had thoroughly charmed her, just as his son had done. "He asked for your address last week, and I told him Jackie and Biddy were keen to change their jobs for some sort of war work." Amy frowned. "Working in a medical instrument factory is hardly war work." "That's what I thought, but he managed to convince the girls it was," her mother told her. Apparently, he's just been given a government contract. Some of his workers have been called up, and he's badly in need of more staff. I suppose it is war work in a sort of way. He didn't seem to mind the girls were so young, and they're thrilled to pieces. Jackie's in the packing department, and Biddy's in the post room. Have you done anything about getting yourself a job, love? Not yet. Amy couldn't make up her mind what she wanted to do. I'm torn between becoming a postwoman or a conductress on the trams, she confessed. Mam said thoughtfully. With one, you'd have to be up at the crack of dawn. With the other, you'd be worked to death running up and down the stairs a million times a day, and you might have to be up at the crack of dawn and all. If I were you, I'd go for the postwoman. I'll think about it. It was already December. It might not be a bad idea to leave it until after Christmas and start the new year with a new job. Just imagine if Barney got a few days' leave over the holiday and they couldn't spend it together. Yes, Amy decided. She'd leave getting a job until the new year. Perhaps she would have done so had she not arranged to meet Charlie in town the following Saturday to buy Christmas presents for Mam and their sisters. They met in Lyons first for a cup of tea. It was one of the coldest days she'd ever known, and she wore her new dark brown velour coat and fur-lined boots. "I have a feeling this will be the last Christmas in a while when there'll be so much to buy in the shops," Charlie said gloomily. "The longer this bloody war lasts, the worse things will get."
"I thought Marion didn't approve of swearing."
"Marion isn't here, is she? I'll swear as much as I bloody will like."
"No, she isn't,"
Amy nearly added, "I'm pleased to say," but thought better of it. Marion was Charlie's choice. He hadn't been forced to marry her.
"What did you mean," she asked, "by the longer the war lasts, the worse things will get?" "It stands to sense, doesn't it?"
He looked at her as if she were an idiot. "There's already a shortage of tea and sugar. We can't expect seamen to risk their lives on a daily basis just so the population can treat itself to endless cuppers. Pretty soon there'll be a shortage of every damn thing that has to be imported." Charlie folded his arms and looked even gloomier. "Not only that, factories will stop producing stuff that doesn't go towards the war effort. Marion wants an umbrella for Christmas before they stop making them.
Do you think Mam would like one too?" he asked hopefully. "She's already got one. Barney bought it for her before he went away."
"What about a nice handbag?" "I brought her a lovely one back from London, and Jackie and Biddy too." Charlie heaved a sigh of annoyance.
"Can you think of anything she wants?"
"Slippers." "I know," Amy cried. "You get her slippers and I'll get her a dressing gown. We'll get them from the same shop so we can make sure the colours match. As for Jackie and Biddy, they'd like makeup. Any sort. You can buy them really pretty makeup bags and I'll get the stuff to go in them."
She was conscious that her usually good-humoured brother wasn't himself today. In fact, she'd never known him so clearly dejected.
"What's wrong, Charlie?" She squeezed his fingers. "Marion just doesn't understand," he said glumly.
"Understand what?" Amy inquired when he went no further. "That I don't want to be in a reserved occupation. I want to join the forces to do something towards the war, not sit behind a bloody drawing board for the next who knows how many years. People will think I'm a coward or an invalid. I'm not sure which I'd hate the most."
Charlie worked in the fuse gear department of the English Electric. His job was important to the war effort and had been categorised as a reserved occupation, meaning he wouldn't be called up. "When I told Marion how fed up I was being a civilian, she took it personally and was dead offended. She thinks I should consider myself lucky not having to leave home."
"What do you think, sis? Did you mind Barney going away?"
"Of course I did."
But she hadn't been remotely offended that Barney had wanted to join the forces, and it hadn't crossed her mind to try to persuade him to stay. She thought Marion was being selfish and unreasonable, but loved her brother too much to say so. They got Mam a lovely blue quilted dressing gown and slippers to match in CNA modes. The makeup for their sisters was bought in Owen Owens. While they were there, Amy picked a pretty enamel brooch for Charlie to buy her.
and he chose a shirt as her present to him. Amy felt pleased with their purchases, but Charlie was still a bit low. She treated him to a beer and a beef sarnie in the Fatted Calf in Tithebarn Street. She had one herself and a glass of white wine. She listened while he forecast that very soon the breweries would have to start producing munitions, and by the time next Christmas came along, beer would be just a pleasant memory. Two men sitting nearby regarded him with horror.
"Oh, don't be daft, Charlie," she poked him in the ribs with her elbow.
The beer and wine drunk and the sarnies eaten, she walked back with him to Exchange Station, an easy place to get a taxi. By now there was snow in the air, and it was even colder. Charlie considered a taxi a monstrous extravagance and didn't hesitate to say so. "You've become too bloody snooty to travel on trains and buses like ordinary people." Amy just shrugged and grinned. At the entrance to the station, her attention was drawn to a large notice headed "London, Midland and Scottish Railways." It announced that the company was desperately short of staff. "There are vacancies for drivers, stokers, porters, ticket collectors, office workers, guards, restaurant car attendants and cleaners. Interested persons should apply at the station master's office next to left luggage." In very small letters at the bottom were the rather grudging words, "Some of these positions are open to women."
"I quite fancy going to and from London every day in the restaurant car," Amy said.
"It'll be dead boring, and being a woman, you'd probably end up a cleaner."
"Oh, Charlie, love, don't be such a misery guts," she chided. "If I were Marion, I'd be only too pleased to see the back of you in this mood."
It seemed that nothing on earth would make Charlie cheer up today.
"Ta-ra," he said grumpily, allowed her to kiss him and made for the train, muttering something about how Marion would think he'd left home.
Amy read the notice again. If she stuck to her other choices, it meant finding addresses, sending for forms, whereas a job with LMS merely required walking across the station and knocking at a door. If she hadn't had the wine, she might not have been quite so impulsive, or if Charlie had stayed, he might have talked her out of it. But Charlie had gone, the wine had been drunk, and to Amy, right now, the idea of working on the railways seemed extremely appealing. The snow hadn't stopped since the day she'd met Charlie in town to buy Christmas presents. That was over a week ago, and it was getting even thicker. She'd told LMS she didn't want to start work until after Christmas. But her patriotism had been questioned, making her feel so awful that she'd agreed to start straight away.
"Next week will do,"
she'd been told curtly. Not by the station master, he was too busy to interview a nobody like her, but by a gruff individual with a beard and a disagreeable manner whose name was Osbert Edwards. Now it was 11:30 on Monday morning, and she was on a steam train with Mr. Edwards, going she knew not where because he refused to tell her.
"You'll see when we get there,"
he said enigmatically through his thick black beard. He also had thick black hair and wasn't wearing a uniform, just an ordinary suit. The names of the stations the train had stopped at had been familiar until it drew up in Fasakerley, a place she'd never heard of, or Kirkby, the station that came next. Hardly anyone got on or off. The train must be virtually empty, she thought. The scenery was flat and desolate, and everywhere was covered with a thick layer of snow. There was hardly a building in sight, just the occasional isolated house. The further away they got from civilization, the more miserable Amy felt.
"Next stops us," said Mr. Edwards. He put on his bowler hat and pulled on a pair of darned black gloves.
He would have made a perfect undertaker. Amy could visualize him walking in front of the hearse with a mournful expression on his long, thin face. The train braked and a few minutes later came to a stop at Pond Wood, another station she'd never known existed. Mr. Edwards opened the door and got out, but made no attempt to give Amy a hand down.
"Thanks," she said sarcastically, but he either didn't hear or took no notice.
The engine driver, his face black with soot, waved and shouted,
"See you, Ozzie!"
And the guard called,
"Are we picking you up on the way back, Oz?"
"Depends how long this takes, Cyril."
The train puffed away. the smoke mingling with the falling snow, so that it was difficult to tell which was which. What did he mean by, "depends how long this takes," Amy wondered. The narrow platform on which they stood contained a small waiting room and two strange, lumpy objects, which she eventually realised were benches hidden beneath a pile of snow. The snow on the ground looked trampled, indicating that people had used the train that morning. A footpath led up to a curved brown stone bridge, and another path sloped down to the platform on the other side. Amy expected Mr. Edwards to make for the path. Instead, he walked to where the platform petered away, and she saw there was a narrow walkway across the railway lines that had been cleared of snow, across which an elderly man in a peaked hat was slowly making progress. He disappeared into a building on the platform opposite, which had a ticket office, a slightly bigger waiting room, ladies' and gents' toilets, and more snow-covered benches. They crossed and entered the ticket office, which was dimly lit by a low-wattage electric bulb. A fire burned in the grate, and the elderly gentleman was sitting in a shabby armchair. He got to his feet, removed his cap to reveal a head as pink and smooth as a baby's bottom, and said respectfully, "Good morning, Mr. Edwards, sir. Is this the young lady you was on about?" "Yes, Maxwell, this is Miss Patterson. She's starting today." Amy was too startled to remind the man she was a married woman. What was she starting today? What was she doing here? "I'll show her the ropes, and I would be grateful if you could make us a cup of tea, if you have any." "No tea, sir, but plenty of milk that I can heat on my little camping stove. You can have that with a bit of cocoa, if it's to your liking, though there's not much cocoa left." "Cocoa would be very welcome, Maxwell. What about you, Miss Patterson?"
"Mrs. Patterson." "Yes, Mr. Maxwell, I'd love a cup of cocoa if there's enough."
While the cocoa was being made, it became clear to Amy that she was being put in charge of Pondwood Station. 20 years ago, it had been Mr. Maxwell's job, but he had retired when he reached the grand old age of 65. He'd returned when the most recent incumbent had left to work in a munitions factory for 3 times the wages. Now 85, the old man had found the job too much for him. Also, he was neglecting the garden that he loved.
"Not that I can get much gardening done in this weather," he said sadly. "Never known snow like it, that I haven't."
Amy was shown how to issue tickets, how to make sense of the timetable, how the stove worked, how to use the telephone, as if she didn't already know, when to blow the whistle to indicate a train could leave the station, only when every single door had been closed, as if she were likely to blow it when they were open, where the forms were kept to order things like refund books, more tickets, pens, pencils and ink, where the broom was kept to sweep the platform, the harpic for the lavatories, the key to wind the station clock, and the ladder with which to reach it, the coal for the fire, the safe where the money was kept at night, and so on, until her head felt dizzy at the amount of information she was expected to take in.
"At any other time, you'd have been given at least a month's training, but training's gone out of the window since the war started," she was told.
The train on which she'd arrived returned, having been to and from Wigan. Mr. Edwards departed on it, after shaking her hand and wishing her luck in her new employment. It was the last sort of employment Amy had wanted. She'd been looking forward to being a tram conductress or a postwoman, becoming a familiar face to hundreds of people, making loads of new friends. Here, she would hardly get to know anyone. Not every train she discovered stopped at Pondwood. Some went straight through. And she had to make sure, when one was expected, that there weren't any children in the vicinity intent on playing dangerous games, or on the bridge, with stones to throw at the driver.
"You've got to have your wits about you, girl,"
William impressed upon her, his old face creased earnestly. He said he preferred to be called William rather than Mr. Maxwell.
"You can't get lost in a book, else you might miss what's going on outside. Once or twice when me wife took over, me being poorly like, she used to bring her knitting."
"What do you do while you're here?" Amy inquired faintly.
"Me? Oh, I just sit and think about me garden. Instead of a clock or a watch when I'd retired, They bought me a little greenhouse, and I sit and think about that and all, like how me tomatoes are doing, and me marrows, and whether me roses will win first prize at the summer fair next year.
I see, Amy said, even more faintly. No matter how hard she tried, she couldn't imagine it ever being summer again. At 6:20, she would lock up the ticket office and catch the 6:27 p.m. train back to Liverpool. She couldn't wait. No more trains would stop at Pondwood Station until the following morning, when she arrived on the 7:15 a.m. from Liverpool and opened up. William left just after 1.
"Elspeth'll have me dinner ready, but I'll pop back late and see how you're getting on," he said as he put on a thick shabby overcoat and woolly hat with a tatty bobble. "I advise you to look in the timetable and make a note of the trains from Lime Street Station to London Euston. Mr. Cookson from the Red House rings at least once a day to ask. There was a time when he'd walk up from Exchange Station to Lime Street every Monday, then come back again on the Friday, having spent 5 days in London where he worked for an Oriental bank. He hasn't done it for quite a while, poor chap. His mind's long gone."
Amy said she'd make a note of the train straight away.
"Another thing," the old man continued, "Miss Cookson. She's Mr. Cookson's sister. Went to Wigan today to see her friend Miss Everett, who's been a bit poorly of late. They met on a cruise in 1898 when they were just girls. She'll probably arrive home on the 2:27. She doesn't like being out in the dark. She's a nice woman, Miss Cookson, but if you let her, she'll keep you talking till the cows come home, so try and get rid of her, but do it politely."
"I'm never anything else," Amy assured him. He left the office and closed the door. Seconds later, his face appeared at the little window where the tickets were sold.
"Oh, and Susan Conway's taken a little uns to Liverpool to see her mam. She'll be back on the 3:45, so you'll need to be ready to give her a hand with the pram. The baby had a bit of a cough this morning, so the less time he's in the cold, the better. There'll be some school kids on the same train, Ronnie and Myra McCarthy. The school lets them off early. Myra's a nice girl, but Ronnie's a proper little scoundrel. Don't forget, you're the station master now, and make sure you don't take any nonsense off him. And don't forget either that the 1:45's due in 3/4 of an hour. You should hear it coming if you keep your ear out. You've to go on the other platform for that. You can either walk across the lines or over the bridge. I'd say the bridge was safer in this weather. If you slipped on the lines, you might catch your foot or summat, and the train would never have time enough to stop before it mowed you down. If any passengers attempt to cross the lines, tell them it's an offence and they'll be up in court before they know it."
After William had gone, Amy made up her mind that when she got home, she would collapse on the stairs making a loud noise. Captain Kirby Green would call an ambulance, she'd be taken to hospital, and tomorrow she would ask one of the nurses to telephone Mr. Edwards to tell him she'd had an accident and would have to leave her job with LMS Railways.
This was probably the most boring job in the entire world.
An afternoon of unrelieved dreariness stretched ahead, and unrelieved hunger. She hadn't thought to bring anything to eat, having assumed they'd either feed her or that there'd be food available to buy. The trouble was, she'd been expecting to be sent somewhere civilised, not to a place she'd never heard of, situated in the back of beyond. She poured the remainder of the milk into a pan and heated it on the stove. There was no cocoa left, but it was better than nothing. The 1:45 p.m. gave a loud hoot as it approached the station. Feeling numb, Amy reached for the cap and jacket hanging behind the door. She was expected to wear them when a train came in. Both were much too big for her. She crossed the bridge and had only just reached the other platform when the train stopped. A woman wearing a beautiful fur coat, a fur hat to match, and soft brown leather boots alighted, gave Amy her ticket and an indifferent nod, and made her way up the path. The driver and the stoker gave Amy appreciative looks and asked her name. The guard waved and deposited a wooden box on the platform. Amy checked that the doors were closed, blew her whistle, raised her arm, and the train chuffed away. She picked up the wooden box, It had a wire lid and contained about 20 fluffy newborn chicks, which were cheeping and falling over each other because the box wasn't nearly big enough to hold them comfortably. A label attached to the lid showed they were for a Mr. P. Alton. Amy wrapped her arms around the box, as if this would keep the chicks warm, then staggered with it over the lines and into the lobby. The woman who'd got off the train was standing inside, clearly waiting for someone to collect her. Amy fell to her knees, still holding the box.
"Oh!"
she wailed when she saw the chicks were sprinkled with snow.
"What's the matter?"
the woman asked, coming over. Her face was perfectly made up, though nothing could hide the wrinkles around her chin and under her eyes.
"It's these chicks," Amy said tearfully. "They look so tiny and helpless."
The woman had brought with her the scent of Chanel No. 5, Amy's favourite perfume. She looked down at the box.
"They do, don't they?" she said in a hollow voice.
"They're like us humans in a way. We're just as helpless.
Sometimes I feel as if I'm being carted around in a box, that I have no say in my own destiny."
The look in her brown eyes was full of despair.
"Don't you sometimes feel like that?"
she whispered, fixing her tragic gaze on Amy.
"Not really,"
Amy whispered back. A car drew up outside, and the woman stepped out into the snow without a word.
"Hello, my darling,"
Amy heard her say. The door slammed, and the car drove away. She carried the chicks into the ticket office and put them near the fire. She felt tempted to take them out one by one and give them a little cuddle. But before she could, the door opened to admit a woman wearing the same overcoat and woolly hat as William had gone home in. She was carrying an earthenware pot covered with a tea towel. Her face was as red as a beetroot, her eyes bright blue, and the hair that stuck out from underneath the hat was like cream straw. The mouth-watering smell coming from the pot was 10 times nicer than Chanel No. 5.
"Brought you some stew, Poppet," she said cheerfully. "Willie said you'd brought nout with you to eat. This has got a dumpling in. Are you partial to barley?"
"I love barley,"
Amy breathed, though she'd never given barley a thought before today.
"Sit down then, Poppet. Here's a spoon. Eat it up quickly before it goes cold-like. As you might have guessed, I'm Elspeth, Willie's wife. How are you getting on?"
She didn't pause for breath, let alone wait for an answer.
"I saw the 1:45 go chuffing past, so you obviously saw that off safely. Don't forget the 2:27 isn't far off, and you need to keep an eye out for Miss Cookson and make sure she doesn't capture you for too long. I expect Willie told you Susan Conway will be along later. She's been to Liverpool to see her mam. Poor thing, she's lived in Pondwood 5 years, but she's still homesick. Goes to see her mam in Scotland Road every Monday and Friday. Was that Mrs. Shawcross what got in the car just now? I was too far away to see proper."
"I don't know who it was. She was wearing a lovely fur coat."
"That'll be Mrs. Shawcross then. The coat's mink.
Lost 3 babies, she did, poor lamb.
The fourth lived, but was killed in the Great War. All that money, but not a penny's worth of happiness out of it."
There was a noise in the lobby and someone tapped on the window.
"I understand me chicks have been sent from Wigan," said a voice with a Lancashire accent, "but there's no sign of them."
"They're in here, in the warm," Amy called.
Elspeth opened the door to admit a nice-looking young man about 6 feet tall. He was wearing a green mackintosh, stout boots and a tweed hat with a narrow brim. He blushed when he saw Amy and nervously shuffled his feet.
"Hello, Peter,"
Elspeth said. Peter merely swallowed and continued to shuffle his feet. He snatched off his hat and fed the brim in circles through his fingers.
"I put the chicks by the fire to keep warm," Amy told him. "Are you taking them in a car?"
I came in the lorry," he stammered.
"Well, you must put them in the cab so they don't get cold," she said sternly. "Have you got a blanket to put over them?"
"No, but I can use some sacks."
He seemed very anxious to please.
"I suppose sacks will do."
"That young man badly needs a wife," Elspeth said when Peter and the chicks had gone.
"I don't suppose you're interested." "Oh, now I remember. Willie said you're already married."
"My husband's in the army," Amy told her.
The afternoon passed more quickly than she expected. Elspeth hadn't been gone long when the 2:27 p.m. arrived from Wigan. Miss Cookson proved as garrulous as William had said. Perhaps another time Amy might have minded, but today it helped pass a few minutes. She helped Susan Conway push the pram containing two small children and a baby up the footpath towards the bridge. The ground was becoming perilously slippy.
"Can I come and talk to you about Liverpool some day when I've got a minute?" Susan asked. "I really miss the pictures and the dance hall since I married John." "Come any time you want," Amy told her.
Myra McCarthy and her scoundrel brother Ronnie must have missed the train and didn't arrive until 5:45 p.m. Perhaps by then Ronnie was too cold and hungry to misbehave. Both children went racing up the path, and Amy returned to the ticket office, her work done for the day, apart from a phone call from a man requesting the times of the trains from Lime Street Station to Euston. She took it for granted that was Mr. Cookson, and a lady buying a return ticket to Liverpool.
"I'm going to the theatre with my friend and staying the night," she told Amy.
Amy put the money in the safe, raked the fire, locked the door, and went to wait for the 6:27 p.m. to Liverpool. Captain Kirby Green emerged from his flat as soon as Amy came in.
"What was it like?" he inquired.
"Awful," Amy wanted to say. "Boring. I hated every minute."
Instead, much to her own surprise, she replied, "It was all right. I'm a station master." That, she realised, had been holding her together throughout the day, had stopped her getting on the first Liverpool train and coming home. She was a station master. Station mistress just didn't sound the same. Master was so much better. As soon as she'd had something to eat, she'd write and tell Barney. Chapter 9, May 1971, Pearl.
"A what?" I gasped.
"A station master," Charles laughed.
"Didn't you know? I thought someone would have told you."
"No. I had no idea that my mother had been a station master during the war. I imagined station masters as unsmiling middle-aged men, possibly with whiskers and half-moon glasses, not pretty young women with tons of blonde hair."
"How old was she then?" I asked.
It was evening, and Charles and I were weeding the garden. Weeds were the bane of his life, and he hated them more than anything. I was kneeling on the grass, digging up the dratted things with an old spoon, when a fierce tug wasn't fierce enough to budge them. It being Wednesday, Marion had stayed behind at work to play badminton. She'd been playing for years and was still hopeless at it.
"Awfully young," Charles replied. "Only 18. "Shouldn't it be station mistress?"
"She preferred master. The thing is," he continued, "we eventually discovered she'd not long had a miscarriage, but she threw herself heart and soul into the job. She started in December, and it was the worst winter anyone had ever known. It didn't stop snowing until March. Every day she'd light the fire in the ticket office, sweep the snow off the platform, wind the clock." He smiled fondly. "She used to write long, long letters to your dad."
"Has anyone got them?"
I asked, butting in. They might have ended up with Uncle Harry or Grandad Patterson. "I'd love to read them." "Not that I know of, love."
"Was she there for the whole war?"
"No, only for about 9 months. She made friends with everyone. Pondwood wasn't exactly a village. It had hardly more than a few dozen houses, a few farms. The summer she was there, the station was a picture, full of flowers. We used to go and see her. We'd go on the train, me and Mam, Jackie and Biddy, some sea captain who lived in the same house as she did. Marion went just the once." His lips tightened and he said scornfully, "As you know, she and your mother never got on." I was surprised. It wasn't often he was critical of Marion. "That's where Jackie met her husband, Peter, on Pondwood Station. I think he'd been sweet on your mam, but she was already married to your dad."
"I knew about the miscarriage."
"It had been in the newspaper reports of the trial."
"She never told anyone at the time."
"Oh, damn," he swore. "That thorn's drawn blood." He sucked his finger.
"You should wear gloves like I do."
"Only sissies wear gloves for gardening, and women."
"Do you know,
he went on. Every day your mother used to take a taxi to and from Exchange Station to get to work and home again. It must have cost her more in taxis than she got in wages. All of a sudden his eyes were moist. I wish you'd known your mother then, Pearl. She was so full of life. It was more than 3 weeks since my mother had written to Charles saying she'd be in touch soon. Kathy Burns thought she might be in hospital, having something done that she didn't want done in prison. Such as? I asked. I'd been summoned when I had a free period on Thursday afternoon. My class was taking singing in the gym and my presence wasn't required. There was a long pause until Kathy admitted that all she could think of was a hysterectomy, and it would have been silly to wait until she came out. What would you do, Pearl, if you'd just got out of prison after 20 years?
I think I'd like to get rid of the smell of prison, I said. The feel of it. I'd want to buy loads of clothes and makeup, get my hair done. Things like that, I finished lamely. It sounded very trite.
It wouldn't have taken very long to do those sort of things. It wouldn't need 3.5 weeks.
Perhaps she fancied a holiday, I suggested.
Kathy Burns was far more preoccupied with my mother's non-appearance than anyone else. Charles was quite laid back about it. Knowing Amy, she'll turn up when she feels like it, he'd said. Harry was equally unconcerned. As long as she's safe, I'm sure we would have heard if something had happened.
I wonder if she went to see Jackie and Biddy, the headmistress mused. She might be in Canada.
She would have told people if she was going to Canada. There would have been no need to keep it to herself.
I suppose you're right.
I noticed there were only 3 cigarette stubs in the ashtray. At least she'd cut down on smoking, despite the fact her friend hadn't come home. Perhaps she was getting used to the idea. Gary Finnegan limped into the classroom the next morning. I saw that there was blood on his right sock. I beckoned him over.
How did you do that, Gary?
I tripped, miss.
Like the last time I had spoken to him about his lip, he refused to meet my eyes. He looked so miserable that I resolved something had to be done. I just knew he hadn't fallen over. I'd asked Joan Flynn to keep an eye on him, and she reported that the other children left him alone.
Too alone in my view, she'd said. But you can't force kids to play with each other. It'd only make things worse. One of these days he'll be accepted, hopefully before the end of the term. By then he'll be a familiar face.
I rolled down his grey sock. His ankle was swollen and bleeding badly. I was convinced it was the result of a kick. I went outside and grabbed one of the older girls in the corridor, who was on her way to her own class.
Will you take this little boy to Mrs. Miller's office, please, and ask her to put some TCP and a plaster on his ankle?
All right, miss,
the girl sang. Sarah Miller was the school secretary, and the first aid box was in her office. I told Gary to come back straight away. Then I began the lesson. It was art. There were no longer desks in the classroom, as there'd been when I went to school, but 4 tables painted different colours, red, blue, yellow and green, with 7 or 8 children seated at each. I gave every child a large sheet of drawing paper, glue, chalk, little squares of coloured cardboard, plastic scissors and other odds and ends, and told them to glue the squares to the paper to make a house and fill in the background with chalk.
I made this one last night.
I held up the house I'd done the night before. I always had to stop myself from making things too skillfully, in case it put the children off.
I've made the roof red, but you can have any colour you like. You can draw trees or children playing, as well as clouds and the sun in the sky.
Can I draw a car outside like me dad's?
Yes, Bally.
Can I have a swing in the garden? We've got a swing in our garden.
Of course you can, Heather.
Little show-off, I thought. I walked around the room. I was continually surprised and upset by how quickly and cleverly some of the children got to work using the cardboard as bricks and sticking them to the paper, while others seemed totally bemused. I made suggestions in a roundabout way so they would think the ideas came from themselves. My watch said 9:30. Gary should have come back by now. Perhaps Sarah Miller had been busy and he'd had to wait. I couldn't stop looking at my watch. A few minutes later I left the classroom with the door open and sped round to the secretary's office, which was next to Miss Burns. There was no sign of Gary when I opened the door.
"Have you seen Gary Finnegan?" I asked. Sarah was a lovely grandmotherly woman with pure silver hair. Everybody liked her.
"Yes, ages ago. I took him round to your classroom, but just pointed to the door and told him to go in. My telephone was ringing, you see, and I had to rush back. Don't tell me he didn't arrive," she groaned. It must have been obvious from my face.
"No, look, can you check the boys' lavatories and anywhere else you can think of? I'll have to get back to my class before a riot breaks out."
"Straight away."
She rushed out of the room while I sped back to my class, who were as quiet as mice, heads bent over their work. I doubt if any had noticed I'd been away. It wasn't long before the conclusion was reached that Gary Finnegan was nowhere on the premises. Cupboards had been searched, as well as the staff room, the storage space under the stage in the assembly hall, the girls' and boys' lavatories, the boiler room, and the coal house, which was now used to store cleaning equipment. When Sarah Miller reported this, I asked her to tell the headmistress. In no time, Kathy Burns came hurrying along to the classroom. An air of quiet panic prevailed.
"Where do you think he can be?" she asked.
Her brown eyes were scared. I was praying that Gary had come to no harm.
"I expect he's at home," I said.
"If he ran, he'd be there by now. Sarah's rung his home, but the line is engaged." I wanted to weep at the idea of the little boy going home by himself, his ankle hurting. He must have been terribly unhappy to run away. No doubt he just wanted his dad and didn't care about the consequences. "He wasn't happy at school," I said. "I think he was being physically bullied." I felt really guilty. I should have looked into it when it happened the first time.
"When was that?"
"Only last week. I asked Joan Flynn to watch out for him. I'd also told Gary I'd like a word with his dad, but he mustn't have passed the message on."
"Don't blame yourself, Pearl," Kathy said kindly. "You have 30 children to look after. You can't give special treatment to every single one."
"No, but..." I didn't go on. This wasn't the time to explain about Gary's circumstances. Rob Finnegan might not have told the school that his son didn't have a mother. Sarah Miller came into the classroom with Gary's address, and Kathy said she'd go round there straight away.
"Can I go, please?"
I put my hand on her arm.
"Miss?"
"Yes, Heather." I'd forgotten all about my class. I did my best to keep the impatience out of my voice.
"Do I have to draw smoke coming out of the chimney? We don't have smoke coming out of our chimney. We've got central heating in our house."
"You don't have to draw anything you don't want to, Heather." I turned to Kathy.
"Can I go round to Gary's house?" I asked again. "I've met his father more than once. I sort of know him."
"If you want, dear. I'll look after the class."
"Ah, I see you're all making houses."
She smiled brightly at the children and began to walk from table to table, making admiring comments. She was a wonderful, inspired teacher.
"Hurry, Pearl," she urged. "If he's not at home, let me know and I'll call the police."
Someone was likely to call the police if they saw me driving. I drove like a maniac round to Gary's house in Sandy Lane. It was an old semi with two bells on a panel beside the door. The bottom bell was for Miss E. Finnegan. I pressed it twice. Almost immediately, Rob Finnegan opened the door. He was holding Gary in his arms. The little boy's eyes were red and swollen. When he saw me, he buried his head in his father's shoulder.
"Yes?"
Rob said shortly. His expression was hard and unfriendly.
"You know why I'm here?"
I hadn't realised it was possible to feel faint with relief. I had to hold the doorframe for support.
"Can I use your phone to tell Miss Burns that Gary's safe? Everyone is worried about him."
"It's a bit late for that." He stood aside. "You can use the phone. It's in the front room." The room was obviously a sitting room. There was a sideboard with a television on top, a bookcase and a small table with three chairs, as well as a bed settee that was still unfolded, the duvet in a heap in the middle. I remember that Rob worked nights and must have been asleep when his son came home. A bright red phone stood on the mantelpiece, the receiver lying upside down beside it. That's why the line had been engaged. I dialed the number of the school and Sarah Miller answered. I told her Gary was all right.
"Safe and sound," I said.
"Oh, thank the Lord for that," she breathed.
I promised I'd be back as soon as I could, and she said,
"I'm sure Miss Burns would want you to take all the time that's necessary."
I said goodbye and turned to see that Rob was lying Gary on the bed. The child's eyes were blinking with tiredness. The morning's events had worn him out. Rob tucked the clothes around him, put his finger to his lips, and nodded towards the door. I followed him back into the hallway, and he entered an untidy kitchen with unwashed dishes on the draining board. I stood in the doorway. "Excuse the mess," he said briefly. "I wasn't expecting visitors." He picked up the kettle. "Would you like some tea? Please don't think I'm being sociable. It's just that I'm desperate for a cup myself, and it would be rude not to offer you one. I'd ask you to go, except I want to know what happened. Why wasn't someone keeping an eye on my son?" He was in a right old state when he got home. How did he manage to leave and get all the way home without anyone noticing? Needless to say, I won't be sending him to that school again. It was as if a shutter had been closed between us. We'd got on well, we're becoming friends, but now I was the enemy. I explained what had happened. "You could hardly call Mrs. Miller neglectful. She brought Gary back to the classroom, just didn't open the door. As soon as we realised he'd gone, the premises were searched. When he couldn't be found, we phoned here, but the line was engaged. I take the receiver off, so I won't be bothered with wrong numbers and people trying to sell me things when I'm trying to sleep." I just nodded. I didn't want him to think I was blaming him for not answering his phone. "What happened to Gary's ankle?" he asked. "I think someone kicked him. Last week his lip was bleeding. When I asked how it was done, he said he'd fallen over." "He told me the same thing, about the lip, that is. We still haven't discussed the ankle. The other week he had a bad bruise on his shoulder. He said he'd banged it on a door. He's not prepared to tell tales on another lad and get him into trouble." "Christ," his eyes were hot with anger, "he's had a bloody awful life. First his mum dies, then we have to leave Uganda, which he loved. We're squashed in this damn place, making life hell for my sister, because I don't want to waste money on rent when it might be needed to buy a house one day soon. And now he's being bullied at school. I mean, the kid's only 5. How much is he supposed to put up with?" Just then, I had a vision. It was the vision of a little girl standing in a doorway, just as I was now. But her arms were hanging at her sides. Her mouth was open, and she was bawling her head off. She was also 5, and she was crying because she couldn't understand anything, because she was terrified. She couldn't understand why life was being so cruel. She'd been taught about God, but didn't think about him while she cried and cried and cried until she felt sick from crying, until her throat ached from it. No one could console her. People kept trying to pick her up, but she pushed them away. There were only 2 people in the world she wanted, her mum and dad. But apparently her dad was dead, and her mum had gone away. "What's the matter?" I'd forgotten where I was. I blinked and found myself in a strange house with a strange man who was looking at me curiously. "Nothing," I muttered. The man, I realised, was Rob Finnegan, and the part of the house we were in belonged to his sister, Beth. For some reason I noticed that his feet were bare. His fair hair was tousled, and his jeans and white T-shirt were crumpled. He no longer looked angry. "You're crying," he said. "Am I?" I rubbed my cheeks with the back of my hand. "I was thinking about something." "It must have been something pretty awful. I've never seen such a look of misery on anyone's face before." There was a weariness in his tone. He had enough on his plate without being landed with his son's neurotic teacher. "I'd better go," I mumbled. "I'm sorry about Gary. If you send him back to school tomorrow, I promise we'll never let him out of our sight. And I'll sort out the bullying." "Don't go." I was halfway down the hall when he caught my arm. "You're not in a fit state to drive. You look awful. Stay and have a cup of tea. See, the kettle's boiled. We can have it in the garden, as there's nowhere else to sit, only Beth's bedroom. Come on," he urged, giving my arm a tug when I just stood there, not knowing what to do. He led me into an old garden with old trees and overgrown bushes. The rough grass had recently been cut. The hedge was thick with May blossom, as white as snow. There was a wooden table, black with age, with benches attached, directly outside the back door.
When I'd left the house that morning, it had been a beautiful day. And it still was. I just hadn't noticed the hours in between. The trees made lacy, shimmering shadows on the grass. I liked it much more than Charles's garden, with its neat lawn and scalloped borders, which looked as if they had been cut with a knife. My uncle pruned, weeded and trimmed everywhere regularly. The garden was his creation. This looked completely natural, as if it belonged to God himself. "If we sit here, I'll be able to hear if Gary wakes up," Rob said. "I won't be a minute with the tea." He made sure I was sitting down before going back inside the house. His former antagonism had completely disappeared, and he was being very kind, very patient. He had hardly been away a minute before returning with the tea in bright orange mugs. "I assume you don't take sugar, as you don't have it in coffee." "That's right. It looks lovely and strong." I took a sip. "Thank you." "What was wrong back there?" he asked. "I hope it wasn't because of me letting off steam. I shouldn't have got on to you like that about Gary. It wasn't your fault he came home. I don't suppose it was anyone's fault. He just saw the opportunity and took it." "But he's obviously unhappy there. Normally he's a very good little boy." "Very good," I concurred. "You've never told me anything about yourself," he said. "Not that there's been much opportunity. The first time we met, all we talked about was the school uniform. The second time it was the cavern and rock and roll. And the third time you were with your friend. You'd just been to the pictures and we talked about films. You've mentioned a Charles and a woman, I can't remember her name, that you lived with. I assumed they were your parents and that you called them by their first names. Some people do." "Charles and Marion are my aunt and uncle. But look, just because..." I didn't know how to put it. "Because I lost control back there. It doesn't mean you have to do anything about it. I'm really sorry. You've got enough to cope with as it is." I was beginning to feel embarrassed, as if I'd accidentally appeared naked in front of him. "Gary and I have been through a lot together, and we'll come through this," he said with conviction. "Trouble is, if someone hurts him, he isn't aggressive enough to hurt them back." There was a cry from indoors. "Dad?" Then more loudly, "Dad!" "Coming, son," Rob hurried inside. I got up and walked down the garden. It wasn't very big, but the trees gave it the appearance of a small park. I stood under the leaves and looked at the sun, the way it sifted through, losing most of its brightness. I threw back my shoulders in order to shake off the heaviness I felt after recalling the little girl. Me, at 5, sobbing my heart out. In the end, Charles had picked me up, wrapped me in his arms. I'd clung to him. I had to cling to someone. A black and white football lay on the grass. I kicked it at a tree trunk. It bounced back and I kicked it again. I was still kicking it when Rob appeared. He had white trainers on his feet. "I've put Gary in the bath," he said. "He was all hot and sticky. He's playing with his plastic duck at the moment." He grinned. "Actually, it's mine, but I'll let him borrow it. I'll go back in a minute. Here, let me have that." I kicked the ball towards him. He seemed to dance with it for a while, bouncing it from one knee to the other, to his head, and back to his knees again. It was then I had this really wonderful idea. Chapter 10, 1939 to 1940. Amy. No more than a few dozen people went every day from Pond Wood to Liverpool, or stations on the way, and even fewer travelled in the other direction to Wigan. A special bus took children to school in Up Holland, but for everyone else in the tiny village who didn't have a car, the only way of getting anywhere was on the train. But now car owners were finding they couldn't manage on the meagre petrol ration, so the number of passengers was fast increasing. Mornings, Amy caught the 7:15 train from Exchange Station. When she got off at Pond Wood, half an hour later, there'd be a few people waiting on Platform 2 for the same train to take them to Wigan. It was always snowing, about to snow, or had just stopped. As the ticket office wasn't open at such an early hour, tickets had been bought the day before, or paid for at the other end. Some people had a contract. By 8:27 a.m. a small crowd of passengers would be sheltering in the waiting room on Platform 1 for the next train to Liverpool.
Among them, Mr. Clegg, a stockbroker who wore a bowler hat and carried a rolled umbrella, and Miss Feathers, a secretary with the Liverpool Victoria Friendly Society. The rest were mainly young girls and a few boys who worked in the big Liverpool shops or offices. There were also Ronnie and Myra McCarthy, who got off at Sandhills and caught another train to their secondary schools in Waterloo, and best friends Benny Carter and Andrew Woods, who only went as far as the next stop, Kirkby, where they worked in a munitions factory. During the rest of the morning, more people would appear, mainly women, some with small children, who were off to the city shops, Wigan Market, or to see relatives. Amy would give the children a sweet and help lift the prams into the guards' van. On Saturday, the trains were mainly occupied by men going to football or rugby matches, and young people off to a tea dance at Reese's Ballroom or to a cinema matinee. The last Liverpool train to stop at Pondwood left Exchange Station at 5:15.